The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
There was a custom of the Buddha that he would, it seems to be that he often would not reject other people's teachings, but he would redefine them for his own purposes. And so there were a number of, you know, ideas and concepts back in India in his time that he would just, you know, redefine. So like one of them was the term Brahman. It seems to be that in the wider world of his time, the word Brahman meant kind of an upper class person. It was, by birth, there were, you know, there was people were born into different castes, and the Brahman was the priest class that often held themselves as being the high caste. And the Buddha was quite happy to use the word Brahman, but he then said a Brahman is someone who lives with ethical purity, regardless of how they're born. And so I don't know how the Brahmins felt about that back then, but so as an example of how he took words and didn't bother with rejecting the word, but just kind of redefined it for himself. And so there was a word back in ancient times that meant psychic powers. And some of you might have heard the word in Sanskrit. It's a siddhi in Sanskrit. And but in Pali, in the language that our tradition is preserved in, the word is iddhi. And so the Buddha took this word as well, and he kind of, you know, didn't say, you know, reject the idea of, or the word, but rather redefined it for his own purposes. And he's kind of redefined it in the way that I think I've heard it from Zen tradition, where someone would ask a Zen master, about miracles. What's a miracle? You know, can you do miracles? And the Zen master says, oh yeah. and then chopping wood and carrying water are miracles. So, you know, back then in ancient times, I suppose, I mean, in India, China, chopping wood and carrying water was a pretty common, very, very common thing. It's like, you know, if you ask someone today, you know, about miracles and say, yeah, I wash my dishes, you know, and I sweep my kitchen floor. Those are miracles. So psychic powers. So the Buddha then defined, he said there's four psychic powers. And these psychic powers are powers when it's translated into English, the title of these, they're called iddhipadas. And pada can mean road, like the Dhammapada, the path of the Dhamma. It could also mean steps. And so the iddhipadas are the steps or the road to these psychic powers. But the way that it's come down to our time in often translated into English, it's the four roads to success or the four roads to power. And what's dropped from this idea, as the Buddha redefined it, is the idea that it involves psychic powers, the way we would think of it. But rather, maybe there are other things that are quite miraculous and wonderful and, you know, involve, you know, tremendous psychic power of great consequence, maybe. Or maybe if I'm allowed to redefine the Buddha, you know, maybe use these words, the iddhi, and translate into English as sacred, four roads to the sacred, because that's a word that many people in the West like. So there are four roads to the sacred. What's sacred? What are the sacred things? And so the four things in the Buddha gave are desire, effort, the quality of your mind, and your capacity to investigate or be discerning. Those are psychic powers. And in my kind of redefining, those are sacred powers. Those are sacred things. The road to the sacred is through those or with those. And I say that, that you know, you don't hear that often Buddhism talking about desire being sacred or desire being a road to success, a road to power. But desire is a very important part of the human life, and it's a miracle that we should have desires. I mean, we used to be, back a few generations, just as amoebas, right? Kind of globs that didn't have many desires. And somewhere along the evolution, we started having the capacity to anticipate, to project into the future, to monitor ourselves, regulate ourselves, see what we need, see what's going on. And then with that kind of more complicated mental processing came also the capacity to have desires, to want something. And in what way is desire sacred? In what way is it a useful part of this kind of roads to power, roads to success? Buddhism often gets the gives the impression that desire is bad to have. Sometimes in popular presentations of Buddhism, it's a kind of simplistic presentation. It's said Buddha taught that there is suffering, and the cause of suffering is desire, and you better stop having desire. And then Zen people like to make it a paradox and say, well, wanting to be free of desire is just more desire. And so that's, you know, just, you know, then you're in trouble. So one way or other, desire sometimes gets a bad rap about how. But in fact, the Buddha was more nuanced, and he had different words for different kinds of desire. And the desire that he defined as being the source or the cause or the condition for suffering, he called in Pali, tanha. And the desire which is part of this roads to success, the sacred desire, is chanda. And tanha is also the Pali word for thirst. So it's like the thirst. So thirst is like a craving, like a drive. When you're really thirsty, then you kind of, all you think about is water or something to drink. When you're thirsting for power, there's a tremendous amount of addiction and greed, attachment maybe to the power. So it's the desire that has a drivenness that's part of it, a compulsivity that is the source of suffering. But there's other forms of desire. And so sometimes there's other forms of desire called chanda. In this list, it's called chanda. And it's the desire in terms of Buddhism itself, it's the desire for practice, the desire for liberation, the desire to be free of suffering, desire for compassion, desire to alleviate other people's suffering. These kinds of desires are essential part of the Buddhist path, and I think they can be seen as being sacred, as being very important. And if we're too dismissive of desire, saying all desire is a problem, then, which I've seen people have that attitude, then they relate to any desire they have as being somehow, I'm not supposed to have, I'm Buddhist, I'm not supposed to have a desire. Even the desire for liberation is, you know, bad, and, you know, just not supposed to have any desire, just not supposed to kind of, I don't know what you're supposed to do, but with that, you know, it's just heaven forbid you have a desire. And then people come to IMC pretending they have no desires. But even coming here required a desire, you know, shh. But this idea that it can be sacred because it's connected to something very precious and very important. The human capacity for the heart, the mind, to be at peace, to be settled on itself, to feel deeply at home, contented, so that it's not craving or agitated or afraid, not caught up and preoccupied with itself, not preoccupied with anything, but just settled and open and present and available, is one of the most beautiful things that anybody could have. When we wish other people to be free of suffering and we really have a sense of how full the capacity of freedom from suffering is, what it really is in the depths of the heart, it's to wish that for them. There's not a greater freedom from suffering than the deep abiding sense of the heart at peace, settled on itself. And we might wish that for someone else, but also to wish it for ourselves is a beautiful thing. It's a profound thing. It's a precious thing. And provided that it's held in the right way, provided we hold it, we relate to it the right way. And it's possible to have a worthwhile desire and to hold it with attachment and craving and expectation. It's possible to hold it, measuring it, using it to measure ourselves, our sense of self, our ego, our identity, or how we want to represent ourselves, how we judge ourselves. It's possible to kind of get all tangled up with it in a way that causes a lot of extra suffering. But in its simple form, without all the expectation and the clinging and measuring ourselves and defining ourselves by it, the desire to be free, the desire to practice, the desire to not suffer, desire to find peace, desire to have love and compassion, is a wonderful thing for human beings to have. And part of walking the Buddhist path is to be able to separate out your desires from the unhealthy desires, unhelpful desires, from the healthy ones. And then even when you have healthy and helpful desires, to sort out the ways of holding it, the ways of relating it, so that having that desire doesn't tie you in knots, doesn't come back and bite you because you hold it the wrong way. But even more so, having the desire and operating a desire is nurturing, is supporting for you. So it kind of feels good to have the desire. It feels right. You feel, not only does it feel right and good, but it helps you feel good about yourself. This is a good desire to have. It's good to want to be at peace. It's good to want to be free. It's good to want to cultivate myself to be a better person. It's good not to be caught up in things. It's good to be of service to the world around us, to grow in my compassion. And so to actually use this as a source of kind of feeling good or settled or content or happy with who we are. So the first of these four sacred roads of the sacred, or the four roads to power, or depending how you translate it, roads to success, is desire. And in fact, you probably can't have a serious spiritual practice of any kind without some kind of desire as part of it. Even the desire to have no desire is a desire. The desire to just kind of let go of it all is kind of a desire. You can't have your life exactly as it is without any change whatsoever and have a spiritual life of any kind at all, because it requires some change. I mean, even if it's totally, completely accepting your life as it is right now, it probably involves some change, because probably things you're not accepting. And so even that involves some kind of change. But to want that change, then not only to want it, to want a change, to want the practice, to want freedom, to want, not only to hold it the right way, to sort out how it's held unhealthily, to get behind it, to honor it, to respect it, to listen to it, is a hard thing to do. There's a lot of messages that people hear in our society about what you're supposed to do and what a successful life is. But to listen very deeply to what is a desire, what's your deepest desire, what's your deepest aspiration, deepest wish, if you're able to separate out all the inherited desires or all the inherited shoulds and shouldn'ts. So you can really listen deeply. If you listen below the pursuit of pleasure, listen below the pursuit of power or status, listen below the pursuit of security. What is it that deep down, what is it that you really most want? So that's one, it's a part of the task, I think, in Buddhism, is to do that kind of deep listening. And it takes a while, because sometimes you come to a Buddhist, hear Buddhist teachings, it's very easy to hear it as one more should. It's one more group of people, teachers, saying this is what you should do, and if you respect the person enough or something, you think the person knows what he or she is saying, you might get hooked in the wrong way. And not really listen to yourself in a deep way. And it's one of my preference is, if you listen to Buddhist teachings, you don't listen to it kind of as one more external thing to take on, like a set of clothes, but you see it as teachings to help you find a way to listen deeply. Listen to yourself quite deeply. What's there? If you get settled, what's your heartfelt desire for what you most want or what's most important for you? So that listening is very important. But the other thing is to have energy for it. You know, to have some real you know, people nowadays in the last decades or whatever love the word passion. And it's not uncommon for people to come to me and say, well, this Buddhism stuff, it seems okay, but where's, is it, you know, all this, you know, non-attachment and letting go of desire and, you know, is there room for passion? And the Buddha didn't have to worry about this word because it's an English word. But he did, in many places in his teachings, emphasized, especially to his monastic students, you should have strong desire. And maybe strong desire, is that passion? Strong desire. And he encouraged them to awaken their desire and have a desire for practice and for liberation. So it's one thing to have a desire and say, well, you know, liberation's good. I have a desire for liberation, for freedom. You know, it's a good thing to have. I'll get to it. Give me chastity, but not today, right? It's a famous... Give me practice, but tomorrow. You know, give me meditation practice and next year. You know, it's a lot of work to do this practice, so you know, I'll get, you know. But to have strong desire, you know, so to be successful with anything, you need to have a certain level of the strength in your desire. So part of this road to success for the Buddha is to not only have desire, but to have strong effort and concentration and focus around the desire. So in terms of doing Buddhist practice, what is your desire? What's your relationship to your desire in practice? Is it really coming from deep inside of yourself, or is just you're believing someone else's idea of desire? And is your and how much oomph is behind your desire? How much follow through is there in desire? Can you apply yourself more? And it's not an all or nothing thing. It's not like, you know, yes or no, but rather it's a matter of degrees. And it's certainly a mistake to think, well, yes, now I'm going to listen to this talk, I'm going to go home, I'm going to do the Olympic level, you know, application of effort for my practice. You'll probably burn out by tomorrow morning. But maybe you can turn up the volume of your effort and your energy a little bit more. You can be more inspired and say, I'm going to, you know, follow through more. So, you know, I said this maybe too many times, but the effort, So that's the first, is desire, road to success. You have to have some kind of desire. The second road to success is effort, to make effort. This is, you know, to have strong effort. This is get behind your desire and apply yourself to act. It's one thing to have a desire and not act on it. Another thing to have a desire and to act on it. And I know that in my mind, I've had a lot of desires I haven't acted on. Some of those desires, you should be very happy I didn't act on. And some of those desires probably would have been good if I'd acted on them. But I was lazy, I was afraid to act on them, I was conflicted about acting on them, and I didn't follow through on things that I would have been better to if I had done. So they say of applying oneself. And so this is where, you know, this little thing I like to say sometimes that, say it this way today, that Buddhist practice doesn't work whatsoever. It simply doesn't work unless you do it. I usually say it about mindfulness. I say mindfulness doesn't work at all if you don't do it. It requires doing. And I know there are people I've known whose idea of doing Buddhist practice or mindfulness practice or meditation practice has mostly been wishful thinking. You know, I'm going to get to it, or yes, it's really great, I read the book, and yes, I understand it, it's really great, it's going to transform me, yes. But, you know, there's never any really follow-through, there's no action, there's no application, no endeavor, no engagement. And so very important, if you want to be successful in whatever you do, if you want to follow, there's the acting. And for some people, that's really the big challenge in their life. So I would like to say, in my redefinition of this, that effort is sacred, can be sacred, done for the right purposes and done in the right way. And so this has to do with having the right desire, the right purpose, but then also practicing the right effort is very important. I have practiced meditation practice in ways that only gave me headaches, and because I was striving, I was pushing, I was expecting, I was kind of wrapped up in funny ways around it. And that's wrong effort, it's not helpful. I've also engaged in meditation and other endeavors with great joy. Just simply because I was doing it. Just the effort of it. I wasn't necessarily good at it. I was just so delighted that I could do it. How lucky. It's like, you know, sometimes if you go for a hike maybe, and you get into the rhythm of the hike and the walk, and it just feels so good that you're doing it. Just like, wow, just to do it is good. And finally, off out of the couch, and I'm walking, and it's good to have that energy. So sometimes just engage in something is good. Just engage in practice. And independent of whether you succeed in it or are good at it. And that kind of approach to endeavoring and effort in Buddhism, Buddhist practice, I think is really helpful. That you can kind of try to fall back on that just doing it is good. Or find a way that just doing it is good. And don't get too wrapped up in the results. Results are important. But, it to be wrapped up and concerned about it and measuring it is not so helpful. I love the little analogy or story of the farmer. She goes out to her field to see how the corn is growing. You know, she just planted the seeds and she wants to see if the corn is growing. And the seedlings are just coming out of the ground and she wants to see if they're growing well. So she pulls them out of the ground. And then you see how well they grow, but then you can't put the corn's not going to transplant well, so you can't put it back and grow it. So if you're constantly measuring how far you've gotten and are you far enough, have you succeeded, you might actually be like pulling the corn plant out. You might not be able to retransplant yourself back into the practice so well. So there's a whole set of skills and understanding and wisdom that's needed together with effort, so that effort is nurturing and meaningful and supportive and not stressful. There's an art or skill in knowing how to make effort so it's balanced, and how to make effort so that it's not only balanced in the moment and how we do it, but how it's balanced with not making effort. If you make a lot of effort, maybe you also need to spend a lot of time resting or recovering or a fallow time. And how do you go back and forth between that? If you make too much effort, try too hard, and just think you have to make more effort, you might just exhaust yourself. But sometimes you need to spend recover in order to come back and have good effort. You need to have a lunch break and come back. So when I first started meditation practice, when I was 20, I had learned about Zen. I was doing Zen meditation. I was learning Zen meditation at the San Francisco Zen Center. And I went there for 2 weeks to be a guest student, to live there 2 weeks and learn about it. And what they did at Zen Center, how the practice of meditation, they meditated twice a day, morning and evening, but never on Sunday. So 6 days a week, but never on Sunday. And no one ever explained to me why they didn't meditate on Sunday. I was 20 years old, and I looked, so this is how they do it. And so after those 2 weeks, I left and started my own meditation practice at home. I just thought, well, that makes sense. I don't know what sense, but and so that became my custom. I would meditate 6 days a week, but never on Sunday. And it's probably good to have. Or the other thing I had, I don't know if this is works for everybody else. So, I mean, some people maybe have the opposite, but this is what I did. I would at some point start going off on meditation retreats, at Zen Center, 7 day retreats. And in the week or two before I'd go on the retreat, I'd stop meditating. And I can't tell you, it wasn't exactly logical or rational, like I knew what I was doing, but that's what I did. And I tend to be a little bit optimistic, in nature, so, put a positive spin on things. So I kind of interpret that as being kind of, that's how it got me kind of cleared out and opened up and ready to do it, was to just not do it for a while and kind of clear the cobwebs or clear out all my associations, meditations, my thoughts, what I'm doing, and just kind of start fresh was maybe my idea. Other people seem to benefit a lot from actually ramping up how much they meditate before a retreat. They find if they meditate once a day, usually they'll do two, and then they get closer to the retreat 3 times a day, and kind of warm up that way. Some people, that works for people. But for me, it worked really well to just, I just stopped. So this idea of balance, of rhythm, of going back and forth is part of effort. The third of these sacred practices, sacred approaches, is the quality of your mind, caretaking for your mind. So the first thing this requires is monitoring your mind, which requires mindfulness. What's the state of your mind, the state of your being? How are you? Are you stressed? Are you relaxed? Are you filled with aversion and anger? Or are you content and happy? Are you filled with greed and desire? Or are you, you know, content or loving or relaxed about how things are? You know, how are you? And why this is important is it's important just to know what's going on, but this quality or the state of your mind is think of it as the soil in which a seed is going to grow. So if you have a barren soil, your seed's not going to grow. If you are trying to grow, if you're trying to grow corn and your field is flooded, the corn's not going to grow in a flooded field. You have to wait until it drains out. If the soil is completely dry, your seed won't grow as well. The soil has to be the right condition. And most of us can't make the seed sprout. You can't stand above it and instruct the seed, thou shalt sprout now. It's a complicated, I think, biochemical process, and probably none of you understand even the mechanics of that biochemical process to even have any guess of how to kind of tease that, make that happen. But what you can do with a seed is you can create the conditions for that seed to sprout. And so when you create the good soil, you water just the soil just the right amount. Some seeds require a little bit extra help, conditions to make them grow, but you create the conditions for it to grow well. And the same thing for us, that if you want to be successful at something, almost anything in life, but especially a spiritual practice, there's what you do, but it's also the conditions you create for the spiritual practice. Because to a great extent, in Buddhist practice, the inner growth that happens in Buddhism, the cultivation of mindfulness, of concentration, requires both effort on your part, but it also requires caretaking to the quality and condition of your state of being, of your mind, and to help and try to create the conditions. So much so that maybe that's the biggest thing you can do. You can have an intention, you have a desire, it's all very important, you can make effort, it's important. But the important, significant changes that happens through Buddhist practice doesn't come because you tell yourself to change, doesn't tell yourself because you do something, but it happens because you create the conditions for that change to happen. There are already beautiful, wonderful seeds inside of you that are just waiting to sprout if you can create the conditions for it. So part of the reason why in Buddha meditation practice you want to be relaxed and not stressed is a relaxed mind is the better soil for these seeds to sprout. So to caretake to the quality of the mind is very important. And then we do what we can to help create a good quality of mind, a better quality of mind. And, it's not that easy to change the quality of your mind, the state of your mind, your mood. You can't kind of just push a button and, go from being depressed to being happy just because you've been told it's a good idea. But you might be able to tip the balance, or you might be able to lean in one direction. You might be able to change a little bit. I've had the experience, and I've read people who give this advice sometimes, that the posture you take in your body affects your mood. And not dramatically, if you're terribly depressed, maybe it doesn't make a difference. But I've been depressed, maybe it was somewhat mild. And then I remember the first time I saw this, I was a college student, and I was feeling really depressed, for me, whatever, I don't know whether, when you hear the story, maybe you think, he couldn't have been so depressed. But I was feeling pretty depressed, and I was just kind of like, a person couldn't slouch lower in the couch than I was. I think like my shoulders were down in the crack, it's kind of lean, my legs were out. I was like, sunk, had despaired and given up on everything. It's like, oh, just And the posture was so dramatically poor that at some point I got curious and noticed that, and I said, what happens if I sit up straight? So I sat up straight, and immediately I felt better. That was quite something to see that. So, you know, even you, maybe you have no control over your state of your mind, like you can't just turn a switch, but maybe you can sit up straighter. Maybe you can change your posture in a way, and maybe that maybe turns the direction of your mind a little bit, changes the mood a little bit. There's a variety of small things you can do. If you think it's, you know, all or nothing, then you're in trouble. But you have some ability to change it, and you're changing the conditions, trying to improve the quality of your mind. Take responsibility for it. Certainly don't be the victim of, or the slave of, poor qualities of mind. All of us will have poor qualities of mind from time to time, but to be the victim of it, a slave of it, is to, oh, poor me, or to act being pushed around by it, or assume this is how it is, this is a done deal. You know, the hope is with strong mindfulness practice, you can feel the state of your mind, the quality of mind, and if it's poor and unskillful, that you'll have the wherewithal to not be caught in it, or not be pushed around by it, or not be oppressed by it. And so it's, you know, so caring for the quality of your mind is a part of the sacred stuff. It's a sacred thing. The quality of your mind, your heart is very important. And so these four, the third of the four roads of success, the four roads of these psychic powers, these miraculous powers, is to be a caretaker of the quality of your mind, the citta. And then the fourth of these is usually translated into English as investigation, discernment. Sometimes it's people who are really Pali scholars have said that actually the word vimamsa maybe is better translated into English as discrimination. Discrimination in the sense of being discerning, of being able to discern the differences between things. And this ability to discern the differences between different things is actually a key component part of mindfulness practice and Buddhist practice. To be able to discern the difference between what is a helpful or healthy thing to do and act on and what is not is healthy or useful to act on. So to, you know, if you feel angry at someone and you just want to kind of yell at them, to have the ability to recognize, you know, to have the discernment, you know, this is not a useful thing to do. I think this is not helpful for me or that person to be yelling and screaming off the top of my head. I think that there's probably more useful things to do. And then have the ability, through that discernment, to not act on what's unhealthy, but to act on what's healthy. And so that you know, that's on a gross level, like yelling at someone. And also at very subtle levels in the mind, maybe that you only see in meditation. In meditation, you see that your mind starts having a certain kind of, it goes down a certain train of thinking, or a certain kind of, moves in a certain direction. You see, this thinking about that is not helpful. Focusing on this right now is not helpful. And so you say, I'll let go of that. I'll come back to my breathing. I'll come back to the present moment. And so there's a recognition, this is not helpful. Some kinds of thinking and meditation can be helpful. So this is helpful. To be discerning between desire which is helpful to have and desire which is not helpful to have is part of the role of this investigation. To be discerning about what kind of effort is helpful to have and what is not helpful to have is part of this investigation. To notice what kind of quality of mind is helpful to have and what is not helpful to have is part of this discerning. So this ability to make a distinctions like this is crucial for Buddhist practice, because you are supposed to become your own teacher. And the only way you can become your own teacher is if you have the ability to read yourself. I love when you give me a chance, people give me a chance. No one's been angry with me yet. But if someone comes up to me and says, you know, can you recommend a really good book in Buddhism to read? If it seems appropriate, I get half the chance to do it, I like to point to them right in their heart and say, right there, that's the book you should read. And because, sooner or later, that is the book you're supposed to read. Your own heart, your own mind, what's going on here. That's where the teachings are found. And you read that book through your power of discernment, discrimination, investigation, what's here. So, finally, this idea of being discerning or discriminating or investigating, seeing more clearly here, is a tremendous protection in doing Buddhist practice, because you can notice when you're doing Buddhist practice, when you're becoming stressed out by it, or when you're becoming too complacent and lackadaisical about it, when you're caught and when you're not caught. So how do you make effort? How can you make greater effort, maybe a courageous effort, to stay relaxed? Being relaxed in the right way is important. How can you make, it's possible to be very vigilant, very diligent, to stay not caught, and to stay relaxed, stay calm. And it might seem like a paradox to have both together, but I think to make strong effort to let go, to make strong effort not to be caught, to make strong effort to be present in a relaxed way is really helpful for this whole process. Or some people here in the West, people use the language of willpower or will. Buddhist teachers in the West, English-speaking Buddhist teachers, almost never use the word will or willpower. But if they prefer language like willingness rather than will, because will seems like too much ego involved and striving and pushing. But to have a strong will to be willing, to have a strong effort to be accepting and present for how things are. They can go hand in hand, these things. In Thailand, I've been told, these four qualities of success are referred to regularly in the culture there as four things which are helpful or needed for success in any endeavor whatsoever, not just Buddhist practice. Need to have desire, need to have effort and energy, need to have the quality of the mind is really crucial, and there needs to be some level of investigation, of learning from the experience, looking what's going on, learning from it, recalibrating, finding your way through it. And for me today, I'd like to call these sacred as a way of maybe a little bit encouraging you to appreciate the value of your capacity for desire and effort and monitoring the quality of your mind and your investigation. These are sacred. These are very special, very precious, very important capacities you have. And exercising those capacities in the right way, it will bring you tremendous benefit. So I hope this made some sense. I wish you well with it. Thank you.